The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
Your crypto questions answered concisely with our experts. Thank you very much for sending those questions by as well. You can keep doing that. I'm at Michelle Martin Radio on Instagram. You can send me your messages there. The first Bitcoin upgrade in 4 years has just been approved by miners around the world. It's called Taproot. It's due to take effect in November. So your question, what's Taproot all about and what does this mean for investors? We'll get to that in a while. Also, making headlines, a U.S. Department of Justice saying it sees the majority of the 4.5 million Bitcoin ransom that was paid to the dark side criminal hacker group for its attack that ultimately took the Colonial Pipeline fuel network down for nearly a week in May. So if you're thinking, isn't anonymity a big part of Bitcoin transactions? How was it that 4.5 million paid to that hacker group was recovered then? We'll get to the bottom of that. And also, you've heard of the Lightning Network. That's a layer atop the Bitcoin blockchain that uses its own special rules to facilitate cheaper and faster transactions. So I was reading, Jack Dorsey from Twitter being asked at a conference, would Twitter add a layer of Lightning to its network to facilitate transactions? And would that, in effect, expand the user case for Bitcoin? And he said, it's a matter of time. So you might be wondering, what is a Lightning Network to begin with? We'll answer those questions. Krishna Ramachandra, Managing Director from Duane Morris Selvam LLC, Senior Advisor to the Global Blockchain Foundation and Chairman of the Helix Initiative, joining us live. Good morning, Krishna. How are you?
I'm very good, Michelle. Good morning.
Good morning. So let's start first up with the question of the Bitcoin and Ether volatility. So we know that earlier on Monday, Bitcoin actually surged past $40,000 for the first time in 2 weeks. This after Elon Musk, Tesla CEO, said the electric car maker would accept it as an alternative payment subject to miners meeting environmental standards. And the widely tracked 200-day simple moving average resistance currently at about $42,484 for Bitcoin. This according to TradingView, that's a technical analysis data source. So broadly, Krishna, we know that market mood has improved ahead of the U.S. Federal Reserve rate decision that's due out tonight, may keep some gains in check. But when you look at Bitcoin and Ether price movements, what do you think is behind some of the recent volatility?
It's a very good question. It's quite a complex answer, actually. But let's just say that it's quite a seminal move right now with this particular volatility, this phase of volatility, because it marks the entrance of the institutional players. And when I mean institutional, I don't refer to the traditional Wall Street institutional players, but perhaps the syndicates, the professional syndicates, which have been working behind the scenes, and they know very well how the technical analysis are going. In fact, to the extent of analyzing how the retail investor would be analyzing it as well, and then preempting it. We've all heard about Wyckoff's technical analysis, which has, traditionally been used for the last, 100 odd years. And to preempt that and to assume that retailers are also using that to some extent, or at least at this phase, to predict how the market will go. So I think it's interesting to see what's happening, because there's a lot at play. You just mentioned the Federal Reserve. Mm. If it was equities, that would have an impact. But now the narrative is not the traditional sources of narrative that one looks at for equity, but for the crypto market, it's a lot deeper. You can also see how the narrative is controlled by the crypto media as well. So now the question is, who controls the crypto media? And it's, you know, it's a new form of media as well. Mm. So because that then flows down to the retail investor. And, you know, as they talk about, you know, distribution and then accumulation by the bigger players, I think we're seeing that now as well. But the thing is, are you aware of what your particular position is in the overall market and who are controlling the levers right now?
Mm. So you're going to take us down that rabbit hole? Who's controlling the levers right now?
Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I think if I can be a bit more philosophical about I would say that for those who have, and I know a lot have been somewhat scarred by the recent volatility, especially the one-day drop as well.
Mm.
You know, just look upon this as a great way to understand the new type of narrative that's being created and in this whole digital asset space per se. And if you like, when you look at investing, you know, or rather you look at investments versus speculation, right? Because this is really speculation. This is just, you know, imagine it's a game of chance and there's no measurement of risks and no matter how much you analyze a particular token or a coin, all of that goes out of the window when the narrative is controlled by a completely different set of data points.
Right.
And so I think for your listeners out there who are, you know, who have done the great thing by opening a, you know, a wallet and maybe had a flutter or two with some of the coins, at least just understand that this is becoming a lot more pervasive, as in digital currencies are becoming a lot more pervasive, and they're going to form a huge part of the behavioral economics. And, you know, if you're an analyst and you are looking at crafting a position for a traditional company, so to speak, then you got to look at the digital economics around it and what is that company looking to do in terms of embracing its growth and whether it is embracing the digital part of its growth. And now let's just look at NFTs, right? So there was so much buzz about NFTs a couple of months ago, and the buzz related around, you know, the price paid for a particular digital art and other things. So after the dust of the speculation and investment parts of that have settled, you then look at how NFTs actually do play a significant role in the digital economy and the companies or the startups or the entities that have actually embraced NFT as part of their ecosystem of value proposition for their customers or their stakeholders. Those are the companies that are ahead of the game. So when we talk about NFTs, you talk about it's a company called Zedrun. You know, they created, instead of crypto kitties, you know, they created, you know, horses, right?
Instead of what, sorry?
Instead of crypto kitties. Yeah.
Kitties, yeah.
Yeah. So something a lot more meaningful, if you like, and this is in the gaming industry. And so they have, you know, they started off with just simply having a horse and, you know, mining those horses. And they're attached, obviously, to an NFT. But then it starts pervasively to enter into other parts of their business ecosystem, because you then have those NFTs, which relate around, you know, you have other NFT holders who have similar horses to compete with each other. Then there's this whole thing about breeding. And it's just quite amazing how they have looked at their customer base, their customers' behavioral patterns and really analyze all of this, then to make NFTs work for them at that level. So that's the significant part of all of this. You know, beyond the investment and speculation and all of that we have.
The broader narrative. No, I totally understand. Totally. I was just speaking with a very famous New York designer, Rebecca Minkoff. So her brand has made over $100 million in sales. And I asked her, I said, what do you think is the next big disruption, wave of disruption for fashion? Mm-hmm. And she said, Michelle, we are studying NFTs. And I thought, yeah, that's brilliant, because in the metaverse, you know, people might want a Rebecca Minkoff bag or outfit. And it's just amazing that, you know, Rebecca Minkoff, well-known designer, openly speaking about studying NFTs very seriously. It just reminded me of NVIDIA's CEO also saying we're on the cusp of a blockchain and NFT-enabled metaverse. So he's one of the most powerful men in tech, saying that this metaverse, a term for this virtual worlds or self-contained economies, interlinked, of course, is just around the corner. So I get what you're saying about the broader narrative. So I wonder if you can help us understand a little bit of the technicalities of Bitcoin, because we've had a question asking about what the taproot is. So for the other listeners, the taproot is Bitcoin's first upgrade in 4 years, just been approved by miners around the world, said to be a rare moment of consensus amongst stakeholders. I'm not sure what a consensus is about, but let's find out with Krishna. What is a taproot, the Bitcoin upgrade, and when it happens in November, Krishna, do you think this is going to be significant for price movements for Bitcoin?
I would imagine it would be somewhat significant, because you would argue that it would have been priced into the market in the upcoming months. But because this particular upgrade involves basically what we call the layer two, which is scalability and efficiency of the protocol, it's going to impact how Bitcoin, if you like, comes to the scene and disrupts the other infrastructure protocols that are out there. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about DeFi on Bitcoin and allowing for DeFi projects to rely on the Bitcoin protocol to actually be a source of various other projects that will then emanate from it. So, but no, Bitcoin has never, if you like, resulted in projects which require constant transacting. And that's been left to Ethereum largely. And so for Bitcoin to enter the scene, it's huge, because Bitcoin has always held the top position for being, you know, the most secure protocol, and you know, it, in a way, it's just got one job, right? It's just meant to be it started off as a currency and as a medium of exchange, and that was it. You know, it had, if you like, the simplest of smart contract languaging into this protocol that was then adopted by the other protocols and then expanded upon, like by Ethereum, into a lot more complex smart contracting language. In fact, NFTs were part of the Ethereum expansion of that original smart contracting language. So for me, I think, you know, if it goes ahead and the devs as well as the miners have agreed, I think there's a 90% threshold that needs to be passed. It's going to be huge, because you'll then have projects which have placed a lot of importance on security and robustness. That means anti-hackability being the key feature. Then you'll see a lot more of those projects coming out of the woodwork to be based on the Bitcoin protocol.
So is it fair to say that this development could unlock the usage case for Bitcoin, helping it go increasingly mainstream?
Yeah, you know, I was previously not long on Bitcoin. I mean, I've always been at best medium term, because I think if its central purpose is just to be a medium of exchange initially, and then, you know, resulting as a store of value. And if you take the view that there will be other digital currencies coming along, then if you strip away that basic feature of store of value, you know, then you start questioning, you know, the use case. But the robustness of its security, the fact that it is truly decentralized, perhaps the only decentralized project out there, although I do like YFI as a philosophically as being a decentralized project as well, but I would say it has reignited, if you like, the original hopes that people had for Bitcoin and what it serves, at least philosophically, because now you have it being equipped with scalability, speed, and all of that potentially when that fork happens, that soft fork happens.
In November. All right. I understand the main change with Taproot is something to do with digital signatures that will afford for greater transaction privacy. Is that to some extent correct? Okay, so speaking on privacy, here's another question. The U.S. Department of Justice recently said it seized the majority of that $4.5 million ransom, Bitcoin ransom, that was paid to a hacker group, the DarkSide, for its attack that ultimately took down the Colonial Pipeline Fuel Network for about a week in May. So this seizure is the first successful investigation by the Justice Department new task force. So I guess, you know, people are seeing this as a race between security and the people behind cryptocurrencies. But what does this all mean for anonymity and Bitcoin? So here's the actual question from a listener. If anonymity is at the heart of Bitcoin transactions, how is it that $4.5 million ransom paid to DarkSide was tracked and recovered?
Good question. And I think this is a very good example of how... we just don't know what the background narrative is. You just mentioned the task force, a new task force. Mm. They certainly want to announce a win, and this is a really easy target to begin with. And number two, DarkSide have actually denied that they were involved in this particular hack. And if you ask me, this is pretty Mickey Mouse in terms of how this whole operations have been conducted, because from what I've heard at least, the authorities were able to audit and trace the accounts through the servers that had been that the hackers had actually placed their private keys on. And And you know, that was the method in which they were traced. It was not linked to, if you like, the actual protocol in itself. Mm-hmm. So that anonymity is still sacred and maintained. Mm. But it is what you go on to do with the subsequent steps, whether it's in how you hold the coins, in on what wallet you use, whether it's hot, whether it's cold, and if you have maintained the tightness of the group, so to speak, because if you have more than one particular person controlling, if you like, the wallet, then you have issues around, you know, what misstep they may have taken. So there's a lot that goes around this. And, you know, there are teams, right? There are teams amongst the Big Four. There are teams amongst authorities, the Big Four accounting firms, and there are teams amongst the authorities as well that do Bitcoin audits to trace the actual original source, because there are a lot of people who state that they have made millions, and you know, it was from Bitcoin, when in actual fact it's traceable at least to that extent, and you have to prove that you had an originating wallet where you had bought it at, like, you know, $20 or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. If you then subsequently claim you have 200 million in that wallet, so that level of traceability is certainly there. I mean, that's the virtue and the beauty of blockchain, right? Because you are able to see, look back to all the transactions from a data level, and to ensure that there is no intervention and there's no alteration which wasn't actually approved by the network as a whole. So, I think, you know, if you were to take little pieces out of this whole story, mm-hmm. then you see a different narrative being formed. I certainly look upon this as, you know, in a sense, right? What is the growing significance of Bitcoin or other digital currencies being used for illicit purposes, right? And is it actually? Because immediately you saw the lawmakers who were, if you like, anti-digital currencies in the U.S. coming down to use this as the narrative and say, oh, exactly why we should not be allowing digital currencies to take center stage. Yeah. So. Yeah, so there's a lot of other narratives, that's what I'm saying, but I don't think the robustness of the security of the transaction in itself, because And if that was also the real dark side, they would have used something like Monero or, you know, and any of the other tokens that would have actually not even allowed for the audit to have been possible.
Interesting. So think critically through the Twitter headlines and try to piece it together for the broader narrative. All right, let's take a look at more on the usage case. So Jack Dorsey, a longtime sort of backer of Bitcoin advocate, recently announced that he and his other payments firm Square, his other company, is considering making a hardware wallet. And he also hinted that Twitter could integrate Bitcoin Layer 2 payments Lightning Network. I have no idea what a Lightning Network is, and neither does the listener who wants to know. Will the Lightning Network facilitate the usage of crypto, Krishna?
Right. Okay. Let's go back to basics, right? So you mentioned taproot, right? So what is a taproot? I mean, you know, if you look at it, it's like, you know, you would have like a carrot, right? And it grows under, you know, beneath the ground, and it just sprouts out various other roots. And so that's the whole idea behind the scalability and layer two, which is to allow for the main highway, so to speak, to continue to flow. And then you have all of these exits, right? So you've got ECP, and then you've got, you know, you've got exit 1, 2, 3, 4, and allow for at the exit point for every transaction to be verified, and for its re-entry for it to also be verified. But what happens when you exit and get into, I don't know, Marine Parade, right, from ECP? Then that's not of the concern for the traffic police, if you like, on the ECP. So the taproot, if you like, is trying to achieve that in terms of layer two. And Lightning was an attempt to create the tributaries from the main expressway, if you like, the side roads, and to ensure that those transactions and the history of those transactions do not re-enter the main highway, because that is going to put a massive load of volume, if you like, onto the main blockchain, which is the biggest issue that Ethereum is facing right now, because every project, or you know, most projects are looking at building out from an Ethereum protocol, and if you then have all that data right on that highway, if you like, let's just say the Ethereum highway, you know, you're going to imagine there's going to be a lot of congestion, and you're going to have gas fees that are so high. And just, you know, so gas fees are like toll, right? Toll fees, right, on the highway. And imagine you have high toll fees, and then there's a lot of traffic as well, as in like congestion. Then you're going to question why even use the ECP, right? Yeah, I'm referring to the East Coast Park Expressway, right? So why even use it? And so for its survival, it's very survival, you know, layer two for Ethereum is going to be critical. And one would question whether we would even be talking about layer two as a distinction, because it is just a necessary step for the efficacy of projects that are based on the DLT technology, for them to have that side chain, if you like, the exit road where all of that happens at a different level, meaning it is managed privately. And then when they re-enter the public highway, so to speak, they are verified, and they continue onto the highway of data sanctity, if you like.
Okay, so the Lightning Network would enable faster, cheaper transactions and user-generated channels to send and receive payments. What do you think if Twitter does integrate Bitcoin and Lightning Network into its system?
Yeah, so you would imagine that the Lightning part of it would be an internal, it would be an internal settlement and data management from Twitter side, right? And so they would do the settlement off the counters. Off the market, off the counter, and then once they have settled all of those with their merchants and their banks, etc., right? Then you go back and you update the main protocol.
So Twitter would become a payment channel, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the stuff that we as consumers, we don't need to know how they would actually rationalize and make that happen, right? But it, because the layer two is being introduced and the scale is allowable now, as in massive scale, it then reinvents the whole narrative and use case for Bitcoin.
Right.
And that's why from being medium, you know, I'm back to long on BTC, because you can now see even the narrative globally in terms of, you know, I know it's a bit of a sideshow, but, you know, El Salvador and you know, the mayor at Miami as well. And, you know, various, everyone wanting to, let's get onto this bandwagon. But it's good if you are a maximalist and you know, you're so pro and long Bitcoin.
Mm.
So that's why I, you know, back to your original question, it's kind of a seminal period of time, not only for the larger digital currency market, but I think even for Bitcoin. It's not yet a done deal and an absolute certainty that Bitcoin is going to really rule the digital currency world, or whether in fact we would have such currencies existing separate from mainstream digital monetary currencies issued by central banks.
Mm.
But I think, you know, it's a lot stronger now, the use case.
And, all right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for helping us tie together all these disparate ties, disparate themes, I should say, and weave it together in a very understandable way. Krishna Ramachandra is Managing Director for Duane Morris Selvam LLC, Senior Advisor to the Global Blockchain Foundation, Chairman of the Helix Initiative, and one of our favorite people to turn to understand the crypto world.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.